This is KGNU's Morning Magazine for Thursday, July 22nd. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, angry political rhetoric makes for angry voters. That's according to the results of a new study co-published by a CU Boulder political scientist. And this time on the Cannabis Report, the state released new marijuana data this week as part of an extensive study mandated by a bill passed during cannabis legalization in 2013. But the report begins with a major disclaimer. Find out why and what's in the report coming up. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have the BBC News headlines. Then Tish Buford hosts today's edition of A Public Affair. Her guest is Xochitl Gaitan of the Colorado Latino Forum. Then at 9 a.m., Maeve Conran brings you the latest radio book club. Then at 9:30, a mix of eclectic music with the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's coming up, so stay tuned to your community radio station. First, we'll start with the headlines with Stacey Johnson.
A coalition of state attorney generals yesterday announced a $26 billion nationwide agreement with three opioid pharmaceutical distributors, Cardinal, McKesson, and AmerisourceBergen, and the opioid manufacturer marketer Johnson & Johnson. The settlement results from coordinated legal action by attorney generals from 14 states, including Colorado. Ratification of the agreement will resolve lawsuits and investigations initiated by numerous states and local governments concerning the company's roles in the opioid crisis. Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser said in a press conference yesterday the companies will pay out settlement money over a span of 18 years.
The three distributors we're talking about today contributed, fueled this epidemic: AmerisourceBergen, Cardinal, and McKesson. This is a big amount of money, $21 billion that they will be paying, given their role. Johnson & Johnson will pay $5 billion. And that will actually be front-loaded, so $3.7 billion will come early.
Colorado could potentially receive at least $300 million if local governments in Colorado agree to the deal. According to Weiser's announcement, ratification of the agreement is contingent on a critical mass of states and their local governments participating, with maximum payments being issued if each state and its local governments support the agreement.
Working with our local government partners, we are prepared to create what we believe can be a national model. It will involve all local governments signing a memorandum of understanding. That memorandum of understanding is critical to the money that we're talking about today flowing to Colorado. And then we will work together with a bottom-up solution where each region will have to decide what mix of priorities makes sense for them. And we're going to work, if you will, hub and spoke, to help support all of these regions with needed infrastructure, support for efforts like workforce training, because we don't have enough behavioral health professionals here in Colorado.
The states will have 30 days to sign on to the agreement, and then local governments of the participating states will have an opportunity to join the settlement. Boulder police say they are winding down their investigation into the University Hill riot that occurred on March 6. According to Boulder police, the riot started out as a small party near 10th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue, and then grew with hundreds participating as the day went on. The gathering, which violated COVID-19 restrictions in place at the time, turned destructive and violent as officers attempted to disperse the crowd. Participants in the disturbance threw rocks and bricks at officers and damaged vehicles of community members. Investigators spent hundreds of hours reviewing over 1,000 video submissions and tips, resulting in 10 arrests, with 3 warrants still outstanding. The Boulder Police also reports that CU Boulder Office of Student Conduct and Conflict Resolution received approximately 200 referrals of possible violations under the Student Code of Conduct. History Colorado has announced that Dr. Nikki Gonzalez, professor of history and vice provost for diversity and inclusion at Regis University, will begin the one-year term as the state's official historian on Colorado Day, Saturday, August 1st. Gonzalez will be making history herself as the first Latina to be Colorado State Historian, a position established in 1924. According to History Colorado, Gonzalez's expertise focuses on Chicana history and Southwest social and political movements. Gonzalez plans to incorporate youth in the exploration of Colorado's past and support more inclusive practices of historical inquiry, along with raising more awareness about historical events with significant contemporary legacies, such as the Sand Creek Massacre of 1864. Fort Collins police announced Tuesday they have arrested a man suspected in a fatal shooting that occurred earlier this week. The victim, who is yet to be publicly identified, was killed in broad daylight on Monday at the 2400 block of South College Avenue. The identity of the victim will be released after family members have been notified. Police say the suspect was arrested and berthed as he was stopped in a stolen vehicle tied to the shooting. The Associated Press reports that insurance premiums are expected to stay stable next year for individuals buying coverage on the Colorado's insurance exchange as the state continues a reinsurance program covering the most expensive cases. Governor Polis issued a statement on Tuesday indicating individuals buying on the exchange are expected to save more than 24% next year as compared to what they would pay without the state reinsurance program. The Associated Press also reports that preliminary estimates suggest that the average cost will be 1.4% more this year, and final plans and rates will be released in October for the buying period that begins November 1st. The Loveland Reporter-Herald reports that the body of an adult woman who died during flooding in Poudre Canyon on Tuesday has been recovered, and officials have identified a third missing person. The identity of the woman has not been released. Two adult males were reported missing Tuesday night, and officials have also identified another adult female who is missing. A flash flood occurred in Poudre Canyon on Tuesday night, causing a flurry of evacuations. Air quality remains poor, with an ozone alert in effect through at least 4 p.m. today. Much of it is due to smoke from wildfires burning across the West. Steve Miller has more.
Wildfire smoke has the Front Range experiencing an increase in levels of both ozone and fine particulate matter as smoke from multiple fires in Northern California, Oregon, Wyoming, and even British Columbia drifts into the area. The Daily Camera reports that Colorado will continue to see smoke through the summer until the end of active wildfire season. For the Front Range today, NOAA has ozone concentrations expected to reach the unhealthy for sensitive group category. Dan Welsh, an air quality meteorologist with the Colorado Air Pollution Control Division, said that ozone levels are typically higher in the summer than other times of year, but the wildfire smoke is contributing to make the air quality index higher than it would normally be. Colleen Reed, an environmental epidemiologist and health geographer at the University of Colorado Boulder, said that the particulate matter from the smoke is so small it can get deep into people's lungs. Reed recommends that people look at the air quality index and be cautious when it gets into the orange, red, or purple level. You can find the air quality index at the Colorado Air Quality website, colorado.gov/air quality. You can also sign up for email alerts at the Regional Air Quality Council website, raqc.org, or you can find the EPA's free air quality app called Air Now at most app stores. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
And weather today, we're looking at sunny skies with a high of 95 with a 20% chance of showers tonight and a low of 68. The National Weather Service predicts highs in the mid-90s most of the week and a 50% chance of thunderstorms Friday night. These predicted storms will create a threat of flash flooding in burn areas. Right now, outside our Boulder studios, it is 73 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Stacy Johnson.
Polarization has become an intensifying characteristic of U.S. politics in recent years. Along with the polarization has been an angry tone of discourse. New research by Colorado-based political scientists argue that this angry rhetoric is fueling a type of emotional contagion. Joining me now is one of the researchers, Carrie Stapleton, political scientist at CU Boulder. Good morning, Carrie.
Good morning, Shannon. Thanks for having me.
First, explain what you mean by the term emotional contagion.
So emotional contagion is a kind of a catch-all phrase, but it basically means that one person's emotions, so when somebody displays their emotions for others to see, the people who see it will take on that emotion that the other person is displaying. So if I'm angry and I display it for other people, sometimes other people will become angrier as well.
What are some of the more common forms of fuel for this emotional contagion?
Usually happier, more positive emotions are easier to transmit. So people, you know, walking down the street will return a smile with a smile, something as small as that. But once you start talking about politics and things that people really care about and really kind of pay attention to and follow closely, then you can start seeing more negative emotions transmit through the population. And that's kind of what the focus of our study was on how anger can easily transmit from one person to the next in the political realm.
In your research, what have you found with the political spectrum of people who are perhaps more susceptible to angry rhetoric?
Yeah, so that was one of the more interesting findings we found in our research, is that it's not only the strong partisans, the people who are always kind of out there, always engaged in the political system, who are going to catch these emotions. You know, it's not only just that group, but it's also these more weakly aligned partisans. These individuals maybe will turn out to vote, maybe they won't. They'll pay attention every once in a while to what's happening in politics. But when they do pay attention, they're very receptive to hearing angry speech from their political leaders. And that is one thing that we found in our research, is that it's these more weakly aligned partisans who actually increase the amount of anger that they report after having seen angry political speech. So it's not just happening with the people on the extreme left or the extreme right. It's really happening with people in the middle as well.
And what are the venues for reaching people who are weakly aligned?
Yeah, so typically in like a political campaign environment, which is kind of where we were focused our study on, you know, it's through TV reports, it's through watching a political debate, it's through turning on cable news or even radio talk. So typically, you know, when these kind of more weakly aligned partisans start to pay attention to politics, when they turn on the TV, when they turn on the radio or watch a political debate, they will see this angry rhetoric. And that can really help or hurt, depending on your perspective, to make this group of individuals more angry. And then there's downstream consequences to that in terms of political participation. We know that angry people are more likely to participate in politics just due to the nature of anger and how it makes people want to approach situations. So there are these downstream consequences from these more weakly aligned partisans turning on the TV or watching a debate and seeing people being publicly angry.
And as a political scientist, what would you recommend as an antidote to this creation of a group of people who are weakly aligned and susceptible to this type of rhetoric?
Yeah, I think it comes down to understanding, you know, that this is happening, and it is there is research in political science that shows that politicians strategically will use anger in certain situations. So I think it really comes down to this understanding that politicians are using these various emotions, including anger, at certain times in a campaign to draw your attention. It's not kind of natural. It's not off the cuff. It's something that they are strategically thinking about doing because they know it will draw attention, and they know that it will have these downstream consequences of making people angrier and then ultimately turning them out to vote. Now, there's other ways they can get people to turn out to vote. It doesn't have to be just making people mad at the other side all the time.
And it's not just in campaigns, but it's also just in the day-to-day media consumption. It's not just an angry tone of voice, but there's also an incentive to write a clickbaity headline. There are social media news cycles that are based entirely on outrage. Where does the ecosystem of the internet come into this?
Yeah, that's a great question, Shannon. It definitely is not just campaigns. It is a whole industry around outrage and anger. And it really, the you know, the issue here is that it draws, as you mentioned, it does draw clicks. It draws engagement. It makes people in, you know, kind of the media industry a lot of money just by, you know, having people be angry, by making other people angrier. And, you know, one thing, you know, social media sites, their algorithms do typically prioritize these outrageous and these anger-inducing posts because they get more clicks, they get more engagement, they get retweeted or reposted on Facebook more often. So they do have this built-in algorithmic system that says, all right, if this anger or this outrageous post is getting more traction, let's send it on to more people. And that is one way that these social media giants are making money. It's through kind of prioritizing these more outrageous and anger-inducing posts. And so that is a, you know, an issue that the social media companies can control based on their algorithms. And it's not just the internet, or it's not just social media companies, it's also our cable news shows. They want, you know, angry people tune in to watch, to figure out, you know, what they're going to be angry about next, or to kind of validate their anger at the other side. And the same is true with, say, talk radio. And so it is just this whole ecosystem around, you know, making these anger-inducing kind of comments, because it's going to make the people watching them angrier, who are then in turn going to watch more, they're going to engage more online, and they're going to buy more merchandise and more books. So it is this whole broad ecosystem that we're now confronting around just this outrage industry.
It's almost as if anger is a form of currency in the attention economy. You and your fellow researcher, Ryan Dawkins, conducted a study with 1,400 survey respondents. What was the range across the political spectrum, and how did you get people involved?
Yeah, so we actually had a great mix between Democrats and Republicans. It was about a 50-50 mix, which is pretty ideal, honestly. And, you know, we typically we used a online recruitment website called the Mechanical Turk, which basically people sign up for to take surveys, to do other little tasks. And, you know, the fact that we got a 50-50 mix, we were pretty happy with, because you typically don't always get that perfect mixture. So we had a great variety of Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives, moderates. So we had a nice variety of people across the political spectrum for the study on anger that we conducted.
People tend to think conservative talk radio when they think of angry rhetoric, but what examples can you give me of angry content from the left side of the political spectrum?
Certainly. And, you know, it's all across the board. This is not a Republican issue. It's not a Democratic issue. This is an American issue. It's happening from both sides. Now, I don't want to say anger always is a bad thing. It's certainly not. The anger is a very strong motivational emotion, and that's how we get change in the world. But when it becomes the only thing we feel or think, then it becomes the issue, I think, that we're confronting right now. And so I guess from the left-hand side, you know, CNN made a lot of money during the Trump era, more money than they had made during the Obama and before. And a lot of that was this outrage over Donald Trump. A lot of it was just being angry about, you know, the latest tweet ex-President Trump did, or the latest thing that he said, you know, in a press conference or whatever it was. So CNN, you know, kind of made a lot of money during the Trump administration simply by kind of pushing this outrage and, you know, pointing out all the things that they didn't like that, you know, ex-President Trump was doing at the time. So this is definitely not just a right-wing side. It's both sides of an issue, or both sides of the aisle are doing this.
Taking a broader view, how do these escalating emotions and use of angry rhetoric affect our ability to function as a healthy society?
Certainly. And that's kind of the ultimate long-term consequence of all of this angry rhetoric, is there is a lot of great political science research out there that shows that angry people are more mistrustful of not only government, but of the other political party. So they don't think the other side has their best interest at heart, or the American interest at heart. They're less likely to compromise. They don't want to come together to work on, you know, an infrastructure bill. They don't want to trust the other side to do a good job, or at least to protect America when the other side wins an election. So then you have people questioning the integrity of the electoral system. And in a democracy, once you start to question that integrity of electoral system, it really becomes problematic, because we rest on the fact that when the other team wins, they win fair and fairly, and then we should just wait our time until the next election. But now that when we start to question what happens in the electoral system, then that becomes this whole problematic thing of, well, the other side is illegitimate and we shouldn't listen to them, or they shouldn't be allowed to rule at, you know, because they won the election. And so there are all of these negative downstream consequences for making people constantly angry about what's happening. And then ultimately, you know, in the extreme version of that, you see violence and rage, and you see people, on January 6th kind of invading the Capitol to stop the electoral vote counting process. And that is a natural outgrowth of constantly making people angry all the time about things. And so those are some of those negative downstream consequences that you find when you just constantly egg people on and make them angrier and angrier.
Kerry Stapleton, political scientist at CU Boulder, thank you so much for coming on the program today.
Thank you for having me, Shannon. I really appreciate it.
And now it's time for an update on what's happening in the world of cannabis with our cannabis correspondent, Leland Rucker. He is the senior editor at thenewstation.com. Leland, thanks for joining us again this morning.
Always good to be here.
All right, so what's going on? Fill us in. We've got new data to go over.
Yeah, we sort of have new data. Let's put it that way. The state this week, just a couple of days ago, released the results of a study on marijuana use in Colorado. And this is mandated by a bill that was passed during legalization in 2013. It's Senate Bill 13283, and it mandated that the Division of Criminal Justice and the Department of Public Safety conduct a study on the impacts of Amendment 64, especially in relation to law enforcement activities. They had to do this. This is part of the law. And this study is very interesting because at the very top, at the very beginning, the study says this: the information presented here should be interpreted with caution. The majority of the data sources vary considerably in terms of what exists historically, and the reliability of some sources has improved over time. Consequently, it is difficult to draw conclusions about the potential effects of marijuana legalization and commercialization on public safety, public health, or youth outcomes, and this may always be the case due to the lack of historical data.
That is quite a disclaimer to have at the very top of a study. My goodness.
Yeah, it certainly is. And it reminds us that we get all kinds of studies, all kinds of research thrown at us. You know, the media throws things at us all the time. And none of this is conclusive. This is just sort of surveys. This is, you know, this is as much as we can gather together. I'm not faulting the people who did this. You know, the Division of Criminal Justice was forced to do this, and this is part of their job. But it says even legalization has affected the whole thing. You know, for example, this is what it says. It says the decreasing social stigma regarding marijuana use could lead individuals to be more likely to report use on surveys, and also to health workers in emergency departments and poison control centers, making marijuana use appear to increase when perhaps it has not. And I think this is important for us to remember, is that people were using cannabis before it was legal. And we don't have any data to support that, because if you were using it when it was illegal, you were probably pretty discreet about it. You wouldn't have mentioned it if you went to the hospital. Now you probably would. It's just something we always have to remember, that data don't necessarily tell truths. They just give us numbers.
So let's dig in. What data did we get from this study?
Well, you know, the report found that fewer people are being arrested. That's not really a surprise. Between 2012 and 2019, the number of arrests fell 68% from 13,000 to 4,000. Now, that's a significant drop. And marijuana possession arrests, which make up the majority of all marijuana arrests, were more than cut in half. Still, the marijuana arrest rate for blacks was more than double that of whites.
Interesting.
You know, we've found this out before, and this data indicates that that hasn't changed very much.
So maybe some other things to look at within the police department there. Let's just
leave it at that, at least in regards to this study. The study notes that there are more officers on the road when we talk about traffic that are trained to recognize drug use. This is the thing about it, that officers may determine that alcohol is impairing the driver, and therefore they won't do any testing on marijuana because it's more expensive and it'll take a lot of time. And it notes that the detection of any cannabinoid in blood is not an indicator of impairment. It just says that there's cannabinoid in the blood. And I think that's something that we always have to remember. And again, it's this thing of we don't have any data before that, so we're starting our baseline data back in 2013, 2014, and we're going from legalization on, not from pre-legalization. And that's going to always affect these numbers. You know, there's another thing about it, the youth usage. Which basically every study that's been done has said that basically it's about the same. Yeah, there are more youth in Colorado who are using cannabis, but the numbers are about the same as they were before legalization. Legalization doesn't seem to have done anything. But the data are from old sources. The data are from 2019, the Healthy Kids Colorado survey, and the National Survey on Drug Use and Health is the other one, and that comes from 2018-2019. So we don't even have updated data on that particular subject. I do think it's interesting that in June 2020, there were 2,709 licensed marijuana businesses registered in Colorado, 2,709, and nearly 60% of those licenses were in the counties of Denver, El Paso, and Pueblo.
The Mecca, the cannabis Mecca.
Yeah. And total revenue from taxes, licenses, and fees. Back in 2014, it was $67 million. Now it's $387 million in 2020. That's a 473% increase. I think it indicates that people like legal cannabis. I'm not sure, but I think that's what it indicates.
Sure sounds like it. Well, Leland, thank you for digging into those numbers for us and keeping us in the loop. We certainly appreciate it.
Good to be here, as always. Good to talk with you, Hannah.
And that was Leland Rucker. He is our cannabis correspondent. He is the senior editor at thenewsstation.com. And I'm KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers.
And that's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Special thanks to Stacey Johnson, Steve Miller, and Hannah Lee Myers.